Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
We're all decked out for Halloween.
Yep.
One of four Halloween episodes that we're doing. And if it's not Halloween and you're listening, I mean, keep going because these are good anytime. But we're particularly excited about these topics because we get to tie them in with our Halloween enthusiasm. In fact, we were recording this in costume.
Yes.
Julie, would you describe your costume to the listeners?
Well, it's kind of hard to describe because I think I just look very, I've got a lot of stainless steel surrounding me right now.
Yes.
And people keep dumping vegetables into me.
Uh-huh.
And then like 2 hours later, I produce a substance. Can you guess what I am?
You look kind of like a robot with soup on you. But I thought that was the costume. Like a soup robot.
That wasn't very complex and just kept spilling my soup.
Yeah.
Right. No. I'm the cloaca machine.
Oh, that's gross.
I know.
Yeah. It's a terrifying Halloween costume, which we will describe a little more detail at the end of this podcast. But we mentioned it in a previous one about digesting robots.
Yeah.
So you are a digesting robot.
I'm more like the pooping duck, and just to make everybody feel better, there's no actual stuff produced by me.
No. But if you had brought in some soft serve chocolate ice cream, that would have been appropriate based on the pictures I've seen of the poop that the cloaca bot produces.
Yes.
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 Okay.
Gosh, now you've told everybody my secret. Okay. So you're sitting over there eating your Halloween candy. What are you?
I am Humpty Hump. See, you notice the glasses and the large fake nose and the furs from, Digital Underground.
Oh, right. I thought it was just Wednesday.
No. No, this is my Humpty Hump costume. A big fan from way back, especially the Digital Underground cameo with Tupac in that horrible Dan Aykroyd movie, Nothing But Trouble.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. I have to say that I have not seen that.
Oh, thankfully. It was like Dan Aykroyd's pet project, and God bless him. It's a horrible film.
Yeah,
it's got Demi Moore in it and Chevy Chase, and it's very Halloween themed, like a kind of a haunted house and all these grotesque characters running around and not really funny at all. And then there's just this huge scene where Digital Underground is brought before the evil judge, one of like 18 characters played by Dan Aykroyd in this, and then they're made to perform.
That sounds like the result of too much money, too much time, and too many stimulants. So speaking of...
Yes, speaking of stimulants.
Not too much time or money, but right. Stimulants.
Speaking of stimulants, we're of course talking about, it's Halloween. You think Halloween, you think Halloween candy. The topic of this particular podcast, the candy corn menace. And we're not just talking about candy corn, but about various candies and just sugar in general as a childhood obsession. And to a certain extent, an adulthood obsession as well.
Yeah. Why kids are so transfixed and why we are too. Why we continue to be sort of going to that siren call of candy, except for candy corn. For me.
For you.
I'm in the camp of hating candy corn. I don't think it really should exist other than to like create little fangs with.
Yeah.
It can be a waxy sculpted, abomination. Yeah.
Well, this was interesting. We were talking about this yesterday, and I asked people on the How Stuff Works main Facebook page. I was like, hey guys, what's your favorite candy and what candies, Halloween type candies, do you find is particularly vile? And a number of people mentioned candy corn. At least one person mentioned my least favorite candy, which happens to be circus peanuts, which are, you know, those giant, like, they're kind of molded to look like a giant swollen peanut. But it's made of some orange.
I thought you were going to say something else.
No. Some sort of orange spongy material that may or may not be food, but is ingested. It's really grim. And then, I asked my wife and, she mentioned, Boston beans as being particularly weird.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Like who would name a candy Boston bean? And then there, we'll talk about some other disgusting candies as we go forth. And also maybe, candies that are not all that disgusting as far as their taste may go, but their marketing has been somewhat questionable. And if I had to pick one though, that I'm not really a candy eater anymore, and this is something we're going to talk about, how adults tend to move more and more away from candy while children cannot get enough. I will occasionally have a hankering for some Twizzlers.
And I bet that it's probably that time of the day when your circadian rhythms have dropped, right? And you need a easy pickup.
Yeah, Twizzler o'clock. Yeah.
Twizzler o'clock, 3 o'clock. I see them on your desk, noshing on them.
Yeah, well, no, you don't. Don't make the listeners, especially my wife, think that I'm pulling out Twizzlers every
day
afternoon.
From your little safe underneath your desk. I don't know what else is in there.
The Twizzler safe, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, great. Now I've got explaining to do. But anyway, so let's move on. So why are kids so into candy? Like, why are they? Because they're just obsessed with it.
Well, we should probably talk about it from an evolutionary perspective.
Yes, yeah. Let's back. Because if they're craving it, there's something at work there. We tend not to crave things unless we need it on some level. So.
Right.
So on a very basic level, like what is sugar about? As a structural material, sugar is involved in just about every aspect of our biology. It's involved in recognizing pathogens, blood clotting, enabling sperm to penetrate the ovum, regulating the half-life of hormones, directing embryonic development, acting as an address code for directing traffic of various cells and proteins. Of course, this doesn't mean that it's a good nutrient. Like it's
right.
When it comes to that, it's like mostly calories and no vitamins, no fiber. And it's like in the good stuff you'll find in things like apples, oranges, other fruits that deliver sugar, but also other helpful things.
Yeah. When we talk about sugar, we should probably acknowledge that, right? So,
yes.
Yeah, definitely fruits carry that. So it's an easy, quick burst of energy.
Yes.
You've got, you know, glucose, and glucose is quite a prize when you're surviving in an environment where food is hard to come by, right?
Right.
So if you came upon an apple, that would be great. Although, of course, apple has fiber, so it's going to fill you up a little bit more. Just from an evolutionary perspective, we know that this would be important for us having a leg up in the survival game.
Right. It gives you a little boost. And as we've discussed in our one of our previous topics about decision fatigue, that boost is not just like a physical energy boost, but can also help you in your ability to navigate the world around you, to figure out what choice you're going to make. Are you going to, when you're running from that sudden saber-toothed tiger attack, are you going to run towards the rock or are you going to run towards the tree? Maybe that fruit you just ate off the ground is going to give you the mental leg up you need to know which place is going to mean your survival.
Yeah, and you brought this up the other day when we were just sort of casually talking about the topic, about how it really does help your decision-making abilities, especially in the context of decision fatigue, which we talked about before.
Right.
And we talked about a study there where the judges were becoming extremely fatigued, and they were making decisions that were – you know, essentially just kind of putting off the parole decision that they were trying to make. And they found that when the judges were given a quick burst of sugar in the form of fruits, that all of a sudden their decision making came back online.
Huh. So it makes you think that like, especially in the courtroom, you basically need a big hummingbird feeder full of sugar water for the judges.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you've got a case at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you should probably bring a snack for the judge. Although you need to clear it with the security guard first.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be bad form if you did not. So let's go in the Wayback Machine and look at Prohibition and how actually.
No, wait, we just traveled back into the past. So aren't we going forward at this point?
Oh, we are.
Well, we're still in the Wayback Machine, but anyway.
Well, yeah. Okay, let's go in the Wayback and Forth Machine.
Okay,
that
we're fast-forwarding then from the saber-toothed tiger dodging ground fruit eating caveman days, and now we're Prohibition. And
yep, everybody's doing the Charleston.
Yeah.
Bugle bead gowns are being worn.
And alcohol is getting itself banned in the United States.
That's right. It's not as readily available. So what do they find is happening? They find that candy like nickel nips, no tittering please, these are wax bottles with sugar syrup, become really popular during Prohibition.
And these are still around. I picked some up as a novelty a few years back to take to Mystery Science Theater Night, which I go to every week. And used to, we would have more of an emphasis on absurd candies like Nerds Rope and stuff.
Yeah.
But we got over that because we're older and wiser. But but I remember bringing some of those, and they're really gross. I mean, I guess like I say, I'm approaching this as a non-candy person. So kids, I'm sure, will still find them very exciting because it's like this little wax bottle filled with something that it's a liquid, and I guess it's like colored sugar water kind of a thing, some sort of weird syrup. And I actually thought about picking some up for this podcast, but we record in the morning, and I was going to have to pick them up in the morning. And I might get arrested if I'm seen buying, what are these called again?
Nickel nips.
Nickel nips. Or I go into a store asking for nickel nips at 8 a.m.
You're probably going to have to go to a specific store for this. I don't think that this is just your corner drugstore.
Yeah, and they're available now, but I don't know if they make them anymore. Like, I have the suspicion that candies like nickel nips and circus peanuts, that they haven't been made in decades. They just made enough of them, and the consumption rate is so low you open a new drugstore and you're just issued some nickel nips and some Boston beans and some circus peanuts, and they're like, all right, you got your candy section.
It's like government issue subsidized.
Yeah.
A shelf life of 500 years. We got to get rid of them. But yeah, I mean, this is what people were tipping back in lieu of alcohol because it was giving them a sugar rush.
And people were drinking like massive amounts of alcohol before Prohibition. That's one thing to keep in mind. It's not just an issue of like, oh, well, we were drinking and then we had this brief period where we cut back because it was illegal, and then we were right back where we started. According to Ken Burns, who currently, or by the time this airs, they may have aired the entire miniseries. They have the new miniseries, Prohibition, that goes into great detail about the roots of Prohibition, and then draw parallels to current political climates. And he pointed out before Prohibition, the average person was consuming somewhere between 90 and 180 bottles per year of alcohol. Booze.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
and a lot of that booze is going to have a fair amount of sugar in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we know, right, exactly. So it's sort of a double whammy. And we know that with the sugar rush and with alcohol, it's going to start affecting the reward center of our brain.
Right.
Right. So this is obviously why we keep coming back to it time and time again. And that's why during that time period, it was viewed as an epidemic.
Right.
So let's talk about the reward center in candy. Basically, we have sugar causing the release of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, our old friend nucleus accumbens, which I feel like we talk about a lot lately, delivering the classic sugar high. So Neuroscience's Behavioral Review reports that binging on sugar stimulates the same euphoric pathway targeted by hardcore drugs like cocaine and can cause similar withdrawal, craving, and cross-sensitization.
So it's no wonder that one of the slang terms for cocaine is nose candy.
So yeah, it's the same ding ding in the brain.
Not to be confused with ding dongs, which are like it's not definitely a candy, I guess, but a junk sweet food. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
And another thing, though, to keep in mind about Prohibition, real quick, is that the alcohol makers and the brewers, a lot of them found themselves unable to legally produce alcohol, so they turned their attention to creating candies or sugary sodas.
That's right.
Yeah. So suddenly a lot of the guys that were in the business of giving you your alcohol were now saying, well, that's illegal, but we have orange soda like crazy, so drink this instead.
Right, and you can get a quick little high and
it'll touch that
way.
Reward system. Yeah, so it's the new drug, orange soda.
Okay, so back in the time machine, a little bit forward here, the Great Depression. Okay.
Oh, yes.
And then now you see candy being completely marketed in another way, right? So as you mentioned, it was in the form of colas.
Right.
But now, I mean, resources are seriously scarce. And people are not able to actually buy a full meal or make a full meal for themselves or their families.
So they go to the store and they buy themselves a chicken dinner candy bar.
That is truth.
Yes.
That sounds insane.
I'm not
insane.
Making that up at all. I looked it up. You can, if you do a Google image search on chicken dinner candy bar, you will find images of this awesome and terrifying, I should stress that it was not flavored like a chicken dinner.
No.
This is not like the candy that they have in Willy Wonka that tastes like a 7-course meal. It's just a candy bar. The gimmick here is, hey, you don't have time or money, et cetera, to have an actual chicken dinner, buy a candy bar instead.
Right. And according to Beth Kemmerling, she's the author of Candy, The Sweet History, that the package actually had a picture of a roasted chicken with like steam coming off of it. Which, again, it just sounds kind of awful and disgusting. But they were trying to market this as healthy and inexpensive.
Hearing that on one level, I'm like, oh, my goodness, what an unenlightened age. Or I want to make, judgments about the differences. But you go to the store now and you have all these things like the Clif bars and various diet and energy bars. And those may not be marketed as here is a substitute for your dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very much the idea of here is the equivalent of a meal or a huge energy punch in bar form.
Well, yeah, but you can also look at fast food joints and the dollar menu is a good example, right? Mm-hmm. So they have, obviously like there's much more protein. There's much more to this in terms of what a person's consuming, but it's the same idea of here's this healthy and inexpensive thing. It's a dollar when in fact it's something that's unhealthy. And it's very much subsidized.
And may have basically come out of a cloaca bot.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see in 2 hours.
Yeah.
but the same sort of idea exists, right? Like whatever you have at your disposal at that time, you've got candy. Let's market it as something that's going to satiate your appetite. So candy has just kind of morphed a little bit, through history in terms of how people have perceived it. But I do really love the fact that it was that this package, this roasted chicken on a package was
yeah,
like as if you just put it right there, then you would believe it. I'm going to eat this chicken. But I also think that it points to how dire the circumstances were at the time.
Right. Now, you mentioned the fast food, and it is important to mention that this sort of stereotypical, the average fast food meal as we conceive it, does pack a huge sugar punch in the form of a supersized cola drink.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, and also additives too. Right.
Yes.
Depending on what you're getting. Okay, so let's talk about kids and why they are such candy fiends and how honestly they can't help themselves.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will discuss these little monsters.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, and then we're back. So on the issue of children and candy, one of the memories that always comes to my mind is that there was this bat mitzvah that my wife shot, and she's a photographer. She was shooting this thing, and I came along to do some on-site printing for the guests. And So you had this entire room just filled with little girls, and they had all the, like their snack bar slash lunch, dinner bar, whatever, I forget what time of day it was, but it was just loaded with things like, Ben and Jerry's ice cream and all sorts of sweets to put on it. And then,
like a cupcake fountain.
Yeah. That kind of thing. I mean, and then of course like pizza and other kind of kid friendly foods as well, but they were just crazy on sugar, and they were just running around, and they would just swoop into the photo booth that we'd set up, and they would just go crazy for these photos. I remember thinking, wow, these kids are insane. And it was just because they were just getting a nonstop rush of sugar. They were just doing more sugar every 5 minutes.
And what's really, it's really funny if the kid doesn't actually belong to you, mm-hmm. and you just get to observe it, but especially with little girls, because in those circumstances, because they usually have dresses on with crinolines and stuff, and then all of a sudden, like, there's like a wrestling pile of them, and they're just so high on sugar, and they start beating each other up. At least the parties I've been to.
Wow.
They're all like little Hulk Hogans. But yes, I mean, this is the result of sugar. It creates even the most docile child becomes a sort of Hulk Hoganed up kid, right?
Right. And it's interesting that you mentioned the Hulk Hogan thing, because, of course, we think of Hulk Hogan, we think hulking up, we think of muscles and bones, and that's actually linked to this, we think. The theory is that a lot of this this sugar craving is linked to rapid bone growth.
Yeah.
That they're hardwired to it because growing bones secrete hormones that influence metabolism. And we know that other metabolic hormones like leptin and insulin can act on areas of the brain that control cravings and appetites, and even directly bind to the tongue, where they affect the preference for sweet taste.
Which is fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Because what they found, this is from an article from NPR called Kids Sugar Craving May Be Biological, is that they found that kids actually have like a different taste landscape, I guess you could say.
Yes. Yeah. This is what really
or sensory palate, really.
Yeah, yeah. They referred to it as kids living in a different sensory world than adults.
Yeah.
It's just like their entire world is turned slightly on its head when it comes to what tastes good and what doesn't.
Yeah, it's very different from an adult. Researcher Julie Minella of the Monell Chemical Senses Center says, quote, kids prefer much more intense sweetness and saltiness than the adult, and it doesn't decrease until late adolescence. And we have some evidence that they may be more sensitive to bitter taste. So when Minella's researchers studied this, what they did is they gave adults a sucrose and water solution that was on par with like your average cola. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the extent that the adults wanted their sugar. They didn't want it any more. They didn't want it really any less. Kids, on the other hand, preferred twice the amount of sugar. And then younger children had absolutely no limit when it came to the amount of sugar that was put in the solution.
They were like, keep dumping it in until the solution cannot hold more sugar before it becomes a big container of damp sugar sludge.
Yeah, they were all like heavy on the sugar and light on the water, if you know what I mean. Wink, wink. That gives you a clue right there that, yes, that's a different sensory palate, which leads us to this whole idea that it is hardwired that for a kid surviving, particularly back in the way back day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the sugar would give them an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think back to Halloween bag of candy days. And, I mean, I would just, over a few days, I would eat all the candy.
Yeah.
And it was like I if you gave me a sack of Tootsie Rolls and told me to eat them now, there's no telling how sick I would become.
Right. There would have to be like some sort of $500 reward,
yeah,
right?
It would be a pretty serious endeavor. But you hand a bag of Tootsie Rolls to like a 6-year-old, and they're like, they won't even blink an eye.
Oh, no. I remember Halloween's in my candy stash and my pillowcase, mm-hmm. and being horribly protective of it because I thought that my brother was going to raid it. So, I mean, you can understand why little kids get so connected to it. This is actually another really interesting thing that came from that article, that sucrose is actually a natural pain reliever in little ones. They gave sucrose solutions to newborns receiving circumcisions and babies receiving immunizations, and they found that there was a significant decrease in pain.
Sugar actually makes them stronger. It actually heals their wounds.
No, it doesn't. But my daughter received a bunch of shots when she was born from like the get-go for a 2-week period. And they did give her sugar water before every single shot.
And now she craves sugar.
Yeah. She has never had candy. But the store around the corner from us has like the old-fashioned-y, like, you know, little bins of candy. And she just will stare at it.
Wow.
For hours she would.
Do you
think she knocks on them sometimes?
She knows what it is.
Oh, yeah.
She has
she's
a general
like
idea of what it must taste like.
Well, because every single children's book, not every single one, but every other one of them talks about candy. So
the children's books talk about candy?
Yeah,
wow,
all the time.
There's no escaping it.
I thought really
maybe there's like they're just hardwired to the point where like a child can hear sugar. You know, they walk into a store and they're like, what's that sound?
They can hear the molecules of sugar. Like
it's sort of grinding. It's...
the follicles in their ears are like that sensitive to sugar. I don't know, but that could be. Who knows? But let's talk about the downside of candy, other than just, you know, having that initial rush and then plummeting with your energy.
A lot of it comes back to our origins and how we evolved and what our diet was originally like. And, you know, generally you'll find some fruit on the ground. You'll eat it. You'll get some sugar out of that, but you'll also get some other things that are important for you in addition to just the pure sugar. And in many cases, you would go for a long period of time without getting sugar. Like sometimes sugar is difficult to acquire. Anyone who's seen the amazing BBC Discovery co-production Human Planet has seen that amazing sequence where the Biaka tribesmen climb this enormous tree to raid this beehive, enormously high, like stories and stories up.
Mm-hmm.
Just climb up with nothing more than like a burning brand, some smoke to ward off some of the bees. And the guy still gets stung just hundreds and hundreds of times while he's retrieving this honey for himself and his family.
But the promise of honey and the sugar rush is so strong. And not just the sugar rush, but the calories, right?
Yeah, like you say, there's a benefit to having it. But in the old days, it was more work or when you got it, you didn't just get the pure sugar. You received other, nutrients.
Right.
And you might not get it every day. Now, it's an entirely different story.
Right. We have to worry about being propped up until the next meal, right? Especially industrialized nations.
I mean, it begins first thing in the morning for some folks with a nice sugary cereal or even like some wholesome oatmeal that has been just attacked with a sugar spoon until it's just standing on end.
That's right. I mean, you really don't have to go that far for it. Scientist Ralph DeLeon at Yale University found that an animal's sweet or fatty foods can act a lot like drugs in the brains, which we've talked about. And there's growing evidence that eating too much of these foods can cause long-term changes in the brain circuits that control eating behavior. So, you know, both animal and human brains include special pathways that make us feel good when we eat, right? And really good when we eat sweet or fatty foods with lots of calories. And he says that drug addiction is really hijacking some of these pathways that evolved to promote food intake for survival reasons.
Huh.
So we talked about dopamine being released in the brain, right? When you eat sugar. And we know that with addiction, that if you abuse a substance, you know, whether it's sugar, if you can call it that, you know, a substance that is really, truly addictive, or alcohol or cocaine, that the more and more you do it, the more and more your dopamine is released. But then your brain backs off on releasing it. It actually stops releasing as much, which then requires the user to go and sort of double up on the substance to get the same sugar high.
Right. So a real sugar junkie is essentially chasing the dragon after a while, to use the old Victorian terminology.
Yeah. Seriously, I mean, they're seeing this. There's actually Teresa Reyes. She's a research assistant professor in the Department of Pharmacology at the University of Pennsylvania. And she was part of a team that gave mice a high-fat diet from the time that they were weaned until they reached 20 weeks. So they gained significant amounts of weight and they became obese. Then the researchers looked at the brain's pleasure centers, which are the areas that we know change in drug addiction. And she said that what we found is that in animals that were obese, there were really dramatic changes in these areas of the brain that participate in telling us how rewarding food is. The changes made these areas less responsive to fatty foods, so an obese mouse would have to eat more fat than a typical mouse to get the same amount of pleasure.
Huh.
And some of these changes didn't go away for these mice, which I think is kind of fascinating, is that the whole idea that it really is changing the way that your brain functions.
Wow.
And then you think about highly processed foods, right? I mean, that's basically just concentrating sugar, you know, to the point where it's no longer just the sugar from a fruit. It's something completely different and much more potent.
Right. I mean, even if you are just talking about the difference between eating an apple and drinking a glass of apple juice, like there's a huge difference in what you're taking in there. But then you add this, like a chemical process on top of that and these varying levels of refinement, you get even farther and farther from the original source.
Well, and from what I read that, you know, when you've got it concentrated like this, the message to your brain is a lot louder, if I can put that in air quotes, than something like a simple sugar in a banana. And so you get a bigger response from the reward center.
So it's essentially like the difference between heroin and opium or say crack cocaine and cocaine. It's like a processed more impactful version of the original substance.
Right. That's really going to mess with your brain a lot more. Mm.
And again, just sugary sodas and juices can make a huge difference. I ran across this study that showed that teens who quit drinking sugared soda and juices lost basically a pound a month over 6 months.
I know. Isn't that insane?
Yeah. And that's not factoring in other things they could potentially cut out.
Yeah.
But just like really sugary sodas and the like.
So, yeah, I mean, the reason why candy is really actually a menace is because of childhood obesity. And we know that from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control here in Atlanta, that they have put some pretty staggering statistics out there.
Yeah. And in not counting situations where the brain has really been reprogrammed in terms of how much sugar it thinks the body needs, it's actually not that difficult for the average person to cut down on their taste for sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think I've seen the figure around like 3 weeks it takes to sort of adjust your taste to something. Say, even if it's something as mild as cutting down from a normal soda to a diet soda.
Mm-hmm.
Tastes weird at first, but they say like 3 weeks thereabouts. That's about how much time it takes to get used to the new flavor.
Right, which makes sense. But, you know, it's just a matter of being aware of it and taking it out. But,
when
you know, in Forks Over Knives, they talked about the childhood obesity rate, and they were actually saying that the coming generation will have a shorter lifespan than ours, mm-hmm. which is kind of like, whoa. I mean, I haven't gone and fact-checked the movie, but I will say that from what the CDC says, they said childhood obesity has more than tripled in the past 30 years because of all these highly processed foods, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because of high fructose corn syrup. And the percentage of children aged 6 to 11 years in the United States who were obese increased from 7% in 1980 to nearly 20% in 2008. Similarly, the percentage of adolescents aged 12 to 19 who were obese increased from 5% to 18% over the same period. So, you know, in 2008, we have more than one-third of children and adolescents who are overweight or obese.
Wow.
Yeah, and the long-term health effects, you know, obviously are many. And, I mean, we're talking about increased incidences of certain cancers, type 2 diabetes, kidney problems, pancreas, the list goes on and on. It's kind of depressing, man. I didn't mean to bring candy down like this.
Well, it leads to the ultimate question here, and that is Halloween is approaching. If you're listening to this, it's at the publication time. And even if you're not, Halloween's going to roll around again. And if not Halloween, then Easter or any of the various holidays that have some sort of marketed candy associated with them, which is pretty much every holiday. So do you give the kids Halloween candy? Do they get to have the candy? Do you try and stop them? Do you dare try and stop them with their strange little zombie minds?
Does your house get egged because you give out apples or toothbrushes?
Yeah.
You don't have anybody in the neighborhood who ever gave out a toothbrush?
No, my dad was a dentist and we didn't give out toothbrushes. We gave out candy. Oh. But then again, as a dentist, you kind of have an incentive to give out candy, I guess.
Yeah. That's what your dad was like. Here you go. Here's the really sweet stuff.
I'll see you at the office. There you go. Well, let me reach into the Halloween bag here and get some listener mail. We happen to have a couple of interesting ones. And the first one does relate to the cloaca bot. Would you describe the cloaca bot? Just to refresh.
I can't remember the artist, but...
Vim Delvo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Vim Delvo, who created this cloaca bot and put it in a really sterile environment, basically put it in a museum with, like, you know, stark white walls around it. And so I can't remember how long this actual bot was, but I'm going to say, like, I don't know, maybe 12 feet or something like that.
Yeah.
And he had a chef actually prepare meals for the cloaca bot and feed it regularly. And then he would add some enzymes, some acids, basically trying to replicate the conditions in your stomach. And lo and behold, that cloaca bot would produce poo, like every 2 hours or so. No, not actually every 2 hours, because it was mimicking the human digestion. But anyway, would then produce actual poo. And then people in the museum would come and look at it, and they could buy the samples.
Wow. Yeah, it really blew our minds when we found out about it, because it also delivers on earlier Victorian attempts or aspirations of mimicking the human biochemical act of digestion with a machine. And this guy comes along and nails it with horrifying results. But of course, we just had pictures to go on, and we have to depend on other people to actually smell the exhibit for us. And our listener Bernard from Australia does just that. He writes, listen to your podcast on the pooping duck. I have witnessed Wim Delvaux's Cloaca Professional in action at the Mona Museum in Hobart, Tasmania. Pics I took below. They feed it lettuce, apparently, and at 3 p.m. every day, it does its thing. I can confirm the smell is realistic, almost. There's something not quite right and disturbing about the smell. Maybe that was all in my mind. As it comes out of the little glass plate it falls on, rotates in a circular pattern to create a Mr. Whippy-like soft serve. There were lots of kids there, and none of them cried. None of them laughed, either. oh, and then he adds, on another subject, was standing on a rock a couple feet in diameter a few yards out into a lake fishing once when a platypus swam up and circled the rock against it a few times, then swam away. I have seen them from a distance many times, but that was special.
I was just blown away by that, because it's two really cool things, right? Like, platypus, right. I mean, you know, we're fans
platypus,
of, right?
Yeah, which is pretty weird, and has a cloaca.
Yes, thank you. And then, yep, and just right around back to actually seeing the cloaca bot in person and then sending his photos.
Yes, these two photos he sent?
I mean, honestly, it looks like a mad scientist laboratory. This looks to be like five hanging vessels, right, with all sorts of tubes that are coming from it. I'm assuming that this is the junk that they put in there to actually break down the food and make it into feces. And it's hanging from a track. It is horrific looking. And then the soft serve is that comes out of the chute onto this plate. I can't believe you're making me describe this. And it kind of looks a little bit like Play-Doh. But anyway, hey, we're always game to putting these up on Facebook if anybody's interested.
Yeah. And so definitely thank you, Bernard, for writing in, not only to share the pictures, but also to describe your firsthand experience with this strange and fascinating exhibit. I mean, we're kind of recoil in horror from it, but it is a very fascinating piece of art. Like, it's not, this dude is obviously creating art that is shocking, that's going to evoke a certain response from the viewer, but it's intelligent work. He's not just messing with
it. No, he is serious about excrement, this artist.
Let's see, we have another email here in response to an older episode we did, 999 Birthday Candles. Writer Evan writes in and says, hi, Robert and Julie, but mostly Robert because this has to do with Dune. I realize that the tie-in with the 999 Birthdays Candle podcast in Dune may have been a little too heady nerdy for most listeners, but the story has significant relevance to the podcast, particularly in terms of maturity. In the later parts of the Dune series, the character Leto II undergoes the transformation to make him part man, part sandworm. He does this so that he can extend his life expectancy to an indefinite period of time. He states that the problems humanity has are a result of typical human life expectancy, and that makes them particularly vulnerable. If they were able to naturally live longer, they might gain a more far-sighted perspective and give up or change their ways. Since a whole race can't do that, Leto II undergoes this transformation and purposely represses almost every aspect of the human race in an effort to build in a race memory of tyranny. By doing so, he was able to mature the entirety of humanity. Because they despised him so, they underwent an exponential expansion when he died, making it so that they would be virtually impossible to wipe out. The golden path, man. The saddest part about this is that Frank Herbert died before he could continue the series. If he could have lived to be a few hundred years old, us fans would have been able to see his vision come to print instead of his son's attempts to fulfill and change that vision. Great podcast. Thanks for the Dune references. So, yeah, indeed, the later books, I mean, the first book, in my opinion, is the best. And then from there, Frank Herbert began to expand this even more elaborate story. And at one point, Leto does change into this enormous sandworm-human hybrid that's featured prominently on the cover art for Emperor of Dune and always intrigued me as a child long before I actually read it. And that particular volume is chocked with full of a lot of like really cool existential ponderings about the state of humanity, the long-term survival of the human race. So indeed, thanks, Evan, for writing in about that and raising that point in regard to the Dune series. And it kind of makes me want to read the first book again.
All right. I just keep thinking of Sting, Dune. As a non-Duner, that's my only reference. And then I start thinking, what if Sting were to live to be 1,000 years old? Would he still be practicing tantric yoga and sex at 999? Would anybody want to see that?
I'm sure there would be a market for it somewhere. But I mean, there's no problem with
super
appreciating
super senior market.
Yeah, there's no problem with appreciating the movie Dune. It's an imperfect adaptation, for sure. It has some definite flaws. It's kind of boring, but it's also got some serious flair in moments. It's got some great costumes, and even, you know, as a Dune fan, you can't help but like something about it.
Right, but you're saying the books are a richer experience.
Well, the first book is a richer experience.
All right.
It's complicated.
Fine, then I'm just going to read the first one and not the rest.
Well, the second one's pretty good, too. Anyway, if you have some thoughts to share with us, they may relate to candy, they may relate to pooping robots, they may relate to the Dune series. Write in. Let us know, you know, especially on the candy and the whole sting thing.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, not together.
No.
Unless you have a candy sting story.
Ooh, that might be good.
Yeah.
You can, of course, find us on Facebook and Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.